Welcome to the Stabbin' Stylists podcast. I'm Randa.
And I'm Ashley.
We are just two stylists who love true crime and hair, and we're going to tell you about both.
This is a true crime podcast. These stories may be disturbing to some. Listener discretion is advised.
And his body never wore a spell. My girl, don't lie to me. Tell me, where did you sleep last night?
Trying to get dropped off a little bit, Plus, she asked to go back to her hotel, but I was just trying to get dropped off a little bit further away from her hotel so we could walk back to her hotel.
Hey, guys. So even if you don't normally use moisturizer on your face, it's cold outside. Moisturize your face.
Yeah.
I mean, that's really – I didn't even warn you to that. I was like, oh, I've got an idea, and just hit record. But no, seriously. I do know some like grown-ass women that are like, oh, I don't really use moisturizer on my face. Well, you should.
Dude, if you're oily, I get it. You don't need a moisturizer, but actually not using moisturizer might be making you more oily.
As someone with oily skin or always thought I just had like drenching, literally had to use the sheets during the day, oily skin, I've realized since I've started using a moisturizer and a primer both, because I would just use the primer. I was like, I have oily skin. I don't want to put anything else on. No, using both of them, my makeup stays longer. My skin is way better. Mm-hmm. So, and if you're going to be outside, you still need some type of products with sunscreen in them because the sun is still the sun, even in wintertime.
True that.
I mean, that's right.
That's a fact.
And actually, people don't realize that in wintertime, you can actually get burnt faster because there's more cloud coverage. So we think that the sun's like UV rays aren't going to be as much of a problem. But they're actually just the same.
They'd be the same, man.
They're the same. It's the same sun. It's the same sun all the time, no matter how much we are not very happy with it right now.
I hate daylight savings time.
Somebody the other day, oh, almost said her last name too, but my friend Brandy, she was like, I love daylight savings time. I said, why?
Why are you like that?
She said, because I like going home and getting my pajamas. I give you that. I know she listens to this. So I'm going to leave her in here. But I give you that. But God, no. Because we work. I mean, like, I hate getting off work whenever it's dark.
Exactly. That's the thing. I hate walking out to my car and it being dark outside. Something about that irks my soul and I hate it.
And it never fails. You do the best hair of your life when it's too dark outside to take pictures.
It's just dark outside. Okay. And it does not look the same inside.
Yep. So. Nothing you can do about it.
I hate it.
It's not great. But yeah, moisturize your hair, moisturize your skin, moisturize.
Go to therapy because seasonal affective disorder is in full swing, clearly.
Right. Trigger warning, this episode contains graphic crime. All right, we've all heard of this one. And if you haven't, well, welcome to the Stab and Stylist podcast.
But
Natalie Holloway was born in Alabama, and so I figured let's do that one because this, me and Natalie Holloway were the same age. Like, this happened when I was graduating high school, so I vividly, like, remember all of this. Natalie was actually born in Memphis, but ended up moving in 1993 to Alabama because her parents got divorced. Her mom, Beth, married a man named Jug Twitty. So her dad's a Holloway, her mom's a Twitty. So sometimes I'll just say their last names.
Yeah.
That's the difference. Now, he was actually a really prominent businessman from Alabama. She graduated with honors, living in a really wealthy suburb in Birmingham. Things were going great for her. She was in the National Honor Society, and she was actually going to go to University of Alabama on a full scholarship for pre-med. So Natalie had everything going for her, and all of her and her classmates were like, let's do a senior trip to Aruba, because why not? And we both been to Aruba. Yep. So the drinking age there is 18.
Yep.
And those kids get wild.
Gorgeous.
Oh, Aruba, yes.
Stunning.
And not just that, it's safe.
It is. It feels very safe.
Even after this and, like, going there knowing this happened, I never at any point.
Honestly, the locals were the friendliest in Aruba.
Yuri has said that for years.
So, I mean, they're very welcoming. They're very warm. They're very nice.
And not just that.
And the food is really good in Aruba. God.
But not just that. Tourism is what brings people in. That is
and
what
they treat it like.
Yes, that. And that is what their whole culture is built on. Exactly. So I'm glad we went on this rant.
Because we're not hating on Aruba.
No, we love we Aruba. Love we are sticking up for Aruba. So Thursday, May 26th, Holloway and 124 other students, all from Mountain Brook, go to Aruba for a 5-day trip. It's like an unofficial trip, though. This is not through the school, but there were chaperones.
This is not school sanctioned, but it's like a group that goes to school together is going.
Yes, like big graduating class. There were chaperones, but the chaperones, because you've got to think a lot of these kids are 18 now.
Yeah.
But the chaperones were not there to keep up with them at all times. Literally, you check in with your chaperone, you go out, do your thing, it's fine. So that night, let me say before that, there was 124 students and 7 chaperones.
Oh, God, yeah.
So
this is not a very strict.
Right. Just let them go. And a lot of people don't realize, too, literally across the street from the hotels in Aruba is where the nightlife is.
Yeah.
They end up going to Carlos and Charlie's, which is a little bit farther down. But I can see why they'd be like, they'll be fine.
Well, the beach
it's just
right there,
too.
Like, everything is within, like, a mile stretch.
Right. It's all right there. Yeah. So I can see. I just don't want to make it look like we're putting shade. Like, oh, there was only 7 chaperones. Like, no, it makes sense.
Like you said, a lot of these kids were 18, legally adult.
Right. Like, about to go off to college, live on their own, start their life.
And they can legally drink there.
Exactly. They were at the Holiday Inn Resort, and that's kind of near the northern end of the island. So that's May 26th when they land. Everything's good for days. Mm-hmm. May 29th, the night before they're supposed to leave, Natalie meets a boy, man, I guess, named Joran Vandersloot. I probably butchered that because I'm Southern. They're all out at the popular bar, Carlos and Charlie's, and they're drinking and they're dancing and they're having fun. Mm-hmm. And right after the bar closes around 1 o'clock, she left in a gray Honda with Joran and his 2 brother friends, Deepak and Satish. The next morning, her packed luggage, her passport, and everything was in her room, but Natalie wasn't. And immediately after her flight, her mother and stepfather flew with private jet down to Aruba to start looking for her. Mm-hmm. We've met someone that was connected to this in Aruba, remember?
Oh, yes.
And he said that Natalie's stepdad and mom were like big donors to the George Bush campaign. And that's how they got so much steam behind them on this. That guy told us details that now that we know all this have been actually 100% true. So who knows? But they fly with a private jet down there and immediately start looking for her. Within 4 hours.
Because let's make no mistake, like the locals want this girl found too.
Yes, absolutely.
You know what I mean? This looks bad for their island.
Exactly. And this is an island they don't normally deal with violent crime.
Exactly.
It's unheard of there. Within 4 hours of Beth landing, they presented the Aruban police with the name and address of Joran Vandersloot, who she left with at the club. She said that his name was given to her by the night manager at the Holiday Inn, who recognized him on videotape.
Cool.
Reports indicate that Natalie did not show up on the hotel lobby footage at any time, but Beth has made different statements as to if the cameras were even operational that night.
Why? If you're going to have cameras, why? Why? Why don't they work?
And especially in 2005, like, this isn't the early 90s. Like, there would... So...
To mention, like, let's not play like these hotels aren't sold as luxury accommodations and y'all ain't got no cameras at work.
Exactly. So April 2006, she made a statement saying that the cameras in the Holiday Inn were not functioning the night Natalie vanished. But she's went and made other statements, even in her book, saying that they were, and that's how she got Joran's name. the police commissioner said she would not have had to go through the lobby to get to her room. It's just crazy that within 4 hours, she had his name. Obviously, some type of either the cameras had to be working or he was there so often that they knew exactly who he was and was like, oh, yeah, that was Jorn.
Yeah.
The police commissioner at the time that was from like mid-2005 till 2006 made sure that everyone knew that those students were wild and partying and there was lots of drinking and lots of room switching every night. And the Holiday Inn told them that they weren't allowed to come back. He said, we know that Natalie drank all day, every day. We have statements. She started every mornings with cocktails. So much drinking that Natalie did not show up to breakfast 2 mornings. Okay. Well, I mean, the drinking age was 18. She was living her best life on freaking vacation. So
breakfast.
Right. That's not, it doesn't matter what she was doing because that was a little bit of victim blaming in my mind. I know he probably has never had to deal with anything like this before, so he probably did not know how to go about it, but it does not matter how much Natalie Holloway had to drink. It does not matter if she was dancing on top of tables at bars. Natalie Holloway did not deserve to go missing. So, and Aruba did care because hundreds of volunteers from Aruba came out and the United States came out. Aruba is actually a Dutch colony.
Yes.
So 50 Dutch Marines were on the shorelines. Aruban banks even raised 20 grand to like help support the volunteer aides. Condoleezza Rice came out and said they were in constant contact with Aruban authorities. This was something literally within days the whole world was watching.
Yes. It escalated quickly.
Her mom was given free housing at the Holiday Inn, and she actually ended up staying in the same room that Natalie stayed in. June 5th, just a few days later, the Aruban police detained 2 former security guards from a nearby hotel, which was closed for renovations at the time. But they arrested them on suspicion of murder and kidnapping. And the guards were known for cruising hotels and picking up women and had one prior incident with law enforcement that I could not find what. But they released them June 13th without being charged. The thing about Aruba is that you're going to realize they bring so many people in and then end up letting them go. Because in Aruba, you don't have to have a warrant. You just have to have a suspicion. But to keep someone in jail, the evidence against them has to keep getting greater. Mm-hmm. You know what I mean? Like,
yeah.
They can't just be like, all right, this is what we've got on you, and we're going to leave you sitting here for 15 years until we figure it out. Within just, you know, a short period of time, if the court says that you're not bringing anything new, you got to release them. So they arrest and let go a lot of people in here, more people than I even realized. So
they're just basically arresting them to interview them.
Yeah, that's exactly what's happening. And pretty much anyone that they have any slight idea it could be them, they arrest them to interview them.
Suspect.
Yes. So then it makes this crazy because there are so many people involved that weren't involved at all.
Right.
So June 9th, which is 4 days after they arrested the 2 security guards, they arrest both Jorn and both the brothers once again on kidnapping and murder.
Right.
Or suspicion of kidnapping and murder. They said that they were actually like closely observing these guys, and they had been for 3 days after she went missing. But what they said was, whenever the pressure came in from the family, they stopped and just went ahead and arrested them. Because they were like, well, they were wiretapping their phones and their emails and all that. And the family was breathing down their neck so much that they were like, we can't keep investigating it. Let's just get his men here. Maybe they'll tell us. Maybe they'll turn on each other is what I think they thought was going to happen. During this whole time, the 3 were just changing their story. They all first said that Jorn and Natalie were dropped off at the Marriott Hotel Beach near the fishermen's huts. But then Jorn said, you know, nope, I just left her there on the beach. I just left her there on the beach and went home. According to Satish, no, Jorn didn't just drop her off on the beach. We dropped them off, and then 40 minutes later, we get a text from Jorn saying we can just go home, that he's going to get his own way home. Whenever the police come to Jorn and they're like, hey, they said that they just dropped you guys off. He was like, no, actually, they dropped me off. They left with her. While they were being held, the Reuben Minister of Justice actually falsely said that Natalie was dead. They knew where her body was and had to retract the statement saying he was a victim of a misinformation campaign. So this is from the beginning. Things are already not going good in this case. Well, he actually said that one of the young men had admitted that something bad happened to Natalie Holloway after the suspects took her to the beach and the suspect was leading the police to the scene. But the next day they came on the news and were like, no, that's not true. June 17th, a sixth person is later arrested. He's a DJ. And one of the... Even the DJ. And that was because either Jorn or one of the brothers, we don't know which one of them said, hey, check out the DJ. At this point, it sounds to me like Jorn's just throwing anybody he can under the bus. Yes. So his dad was a justice official for the island, a Dutch justice official. And there's been a lot of speculation through this entire time that his dad had something to do with this. Nobody can ever prove it. His dad's dead now. But so...
allegedly, for educational purposes only.
Right. So they actually even end up arresting his dad and then release the dad and the DJ. By July 4th, the Royal Netherlands Air Force was deploying aircrafts with infrared sensors. They had a satellite that were doing picture comparisons to the pictures they had taken.
Yeah.
No graves were found. At that point, it looked to them like she had just fallen off the face of the earth. Around the same time, a local
disappeared.
A local gardener came forward with information, and they drained a small pond near the Aruba Racquet Club because they said that they saw Jorn hiding his face as he drove into the racquet club with the brothers. There was a jogger. He's claimed to have seen a man bearing a blonde-haired woman in a landfill during the afternoon of May 30th. They actually checked the whole landfill three times, and once even with FBI cadaver dogs. Nothing was ever found there. Her family and donors actually initially offered like $200,000 for her safe return. But then 2 months later, after her disappearance, it actually increased to $1 million and a $100,000 reward for anybody that gave any tips that led to her remains. The brothers were rearrested in August after another suspect named Freddie was having inappropriate physical conduct with an underage girl. And the Jorn and the brothers were involved in the incident. Because he's a real trash human being, Jorn Vandersloot starts giving a lot of different interviews to different news stations about what happened that night. The most notable one was a three-night interview on Fox News in March 2006. So this is not even a year after this poor girl has been missing. This motherfucker is already on the news out there touting his story. What he had to say on Fox News was that she wanted to have sex with him, but he didn't because he didn't have a condom. So she said she'd just stay on the beach, and he had to go to school in the morning. So the brothers came and picked him up at 3 o'clock in the morning, and he just left her sitting alone on the beach. And he was ashamed to have left that young woman sitting alone on the beach, even if it was by her own request. And he was not truthful because he thought that she would show up pretty quickly.
You full of shit.
Yes. This girl has not even been missing a year. Like, her family is still actively searching daily for her. And you're sitting up there trashing her name? Initially, Natalie's family was saying, you know, don't boycott travel to Aruba. They're great here. They're really trying. And all of this changed pretty quickly to where her stepdad was really vocal not to go to Aruba and other Dutch territories, you know, safety issues. And actually, in November, Governor Bob Riley and the Holloways urged Alabamians to boycott Aruba. So they were actually writing other governors seeking their support, and Georgia and Arkansas actually called for the boycott also. Philadelphia City Council voted to ask for it, but the Philadelphia governor was like, no. And even Dr. Phil went on his show and showed parts of a hidden camera interview with Deepak, one of the brothers, saying that Natalie had sex with all three of the men. There was so much going on Aruba was getting so much of the blame for it. And let's remember, Jorn Vandersloot isn't even fucking from Aruba.
That's what I kept thinking of. It's not even a local that did this. Like,
no. By January 2006, FBI were starting to re-interview her classmates, and they were still searching for her body in the sand dunes and the areas close to the Marriott Beach. By April 11th, 2006, her dad published a book called Aruba, The Tragic Untold Story of Natalie Holloway and Corruption in Paradise. At the same time, Jorn Vandersloot and a reporter wrote a book. It's called Dzak Natalie Holloway, The Case of Natalie Holloway. It was published in Dutch in April 2007, not even 2 years after this girl's been missing. And in the book, he gives his perspective of the night everything happened and the media frenzy, and he apologizes and maintains his innocence through the whole thing, which is a very If I Did It by OJ situation.
If the glove fits, you must.
By April 27th of 2006, they were actually searching the Vandersloot home. They were taking out computers, and they actually had big rods that they were doing down in the ground to, you know, see if it hit anything, to see if maybe possibly she was even buried there. Then they go and check the brother's house, and still nothing. So by November 21st, 2007, they swear by this time, all right, we've got the evidence, we're arresting them, we can actually keep them for causing bodily harm that resulted in the death of Natalie Holloway. Vandersloot was actually in the Netherlands at the time, so Dutch took him in, Aruba takes the brothers in. They returned Vandersloot to Aruba. The judge ordered a release of the brothers because they said, no, you're not giving us any evidence on them. Vandersloot was released on lack of evidence, and they could actually not even prove that Natalie Holloway had died of a violent crime. So at that point, they said, case closed. Aruba has a statute of limitations, 12 years on murder. By January 2008, a Dutch crime reporter comes forward, and he's like, I got it. I've solved this case. And this is when you start seeing the videos of Jorn Vandersloot in a car talking to someone about what they're smoking weed, and they're kind of sitting in the car talking. It's what people consider his first confession on tape. This is where this happens. And basically, this guy's just hanging out with Jorn. They're smoking weed. Jorn doesn't even realize he's being taped. This guy comes forward, and this is his confession. What Jorn Vandersloot says in this, he was with Natalie, and she just began shaking, just convulsing and shaking, and was unresponsive. And he attempted to revive her, couldn't, called a friend. The friend disposed of the body. Jorn says, I was just telling him what he wanted to hear. So they're like, okay, we got him on tape saying this. Let's go. Let's arrest him. And the judge says, nope. Those are not consistent with any evidence we have. They didn't have any evidence. Remember, that's why they closed the case. And that's not sufficient. Even though that came out of his own mouth on this tape, that's not sufficient. We can't hold him. And they let him go. So once again, Jorn's back on Fox News November 24th. And this time, he tells everyone that he sold Natalie into sex slavery, receiving money both when she was taken and later on to keep her quiet. He also alleged that his father played off two police officers that learned that she was taken to Venezuela. They aired an audio recording of Jorn and his father on a phone conversation of his dad basically confirming he was involved in the trafficking. But that was actually later proved that was just Jorn talking in two different voices to himself to pretend like he was his dad. By February 2010, he's given statements that he disposed of her body in a marsh in Aruba. And the investigator said, nope, the locations, names, times, so this just don't make sense. March 2010, there was an underwater search because an American couple say that they were snorkeling. They found human skeletal remains. No remains were ever discovered. March 29th, 2010, Jorn Vandersloot contacted Beth's lawyer and offered to reveal the location of Natalie's body for $250,000. But he only wanted $25,000 of it at first. So the lawyer immediately called the FBI. And the FBI was like, okay, well, let's set him up. So he had 15,000 wire transferred into his account in the Netherlands. And then 10,000, he was like picking up literally like the briefcase of money, and they videotaped him doing that. I wonder if they sold, like, did half of it in the wire, because they were like, all right, well, we'll get you on wire fraud too.
Yeah, that's probably why.
What he told the family at this point was that there was this house that was being built, and basically her body was buried underneath the house. What they say is, no, that house was not built for years after. So he's making that shit up. There's no way. And during all this time, her mom actually started the Natalie Holloway Resource Center, and they opened a little area at the National Museum of Crime and Punishment in D.C., and they help aid families who have missing people. She has founded the International Safe Travels Foundation, and it's to help people that want to travel, basically teach them how to do it safely. Mm-hmm. May 30th, 2010, 5 years to the day of Holloway's disappearance, Joran Vandersloot murdered Stephanie Flores Ramirez, a 21-year-old business student in Lima, Peru.
Y'all motherfuckers could have prevented that.
Mm-hmm. A hotel guest and employee came forward to say they saw them enter the hotel room together, and the police actually found a video of them playing cards that night because they were there for the Atlantic City Casino in the Latin America Poker Tour. So that's why he was even there. She was found dead 3 days later in the room registered to his name, and they arrested him on the murder charge in Chile.
I think.
And they took him to Peru. I know. I was like, I don't feel like I ever have said that right. So he immediately confessed. He said, okay, so what happened was she was on my laptop without asking. Okay. She found a bunch of stuff on that laptop about the fact that, you know, I'm suspected in killing Natalie Holloway, and I killed her for it. He was charged with first-degree murder and robbery, and they actually announced an agreement to let investigators from Aruba come to Peru and talk to him. Mm-hmm. That June, he was charged here in the U.S. for extortion and wire fraud and was indicted on those charges. So they did a June 4th raid from two homes in the Netherlands where he was at, and they found a bunch of information that linked back to Beth Holloway. He just said that he just wanted to get back at her family for making his life hell for 5 years. And that's the reason that he had extorted the money from them. Dave Holloway, 6 years after Natalie died, had to file a legal petition for her to be declared legally dead. The day after that was passed, Joran Vandersloot was sentenced to 28 years in prison. And so by this point, Dave Holloway's like, this motherfucker's in jail. They're never going to get anything from him. Let's start digging up some clues. So he gets a private investigator. This private investigator meets this guy named Gabriel. Gabriel says, I was roommates with one of Joran Vandersloot's best friends at the time. And this best friend told me that, yeah, they essentially smashed Natalie's bones into a powder, right? He said this to the Oxygen Channel. Beth ends up suing the Oxygen Channel because they actually misled her into giving like DNA samples for this show. These people have been completely just fucked over multiple times when it comes to like media stuff.
DNA samples for what?
These supposed smashed up bones. On the show, his roommate claimed to have helped Joran Vandersloot dig up, smash, and cremate Holloway's bones. Using this information, the investigator found what appeared to be human bones. I thought they were smashed up. How'd you find anything? And the DNA testing concluded that one piece was not Natalie's. And he lied for fame, which is fucking gross. June 23rd, Joran Vandersloot was officially extradited to the U.S. from Peru. And on June 9th, he was arraigned with one count of wire fraud and one count of extortion, which he pled not guilty. But by October, he confessed in a proffer letter. So I looked that up. A proffer letter is a written agreement between a prosecutor and a defendant or a prospective witness that allows the defendant or witness to give the prosecutor information about an alleged crime while limiting the prosecutor's ability to use that information against him or her. So basically, they're saying, if you tell us what happened, we won't charge you for it. And that's how they got his confession.
I don't like that.
Well, he's already got the wire fraud stuff. So I guess they felt like that would be, because once again, Aruba has a statute of limitations, so he can't go to jail for her murder in Aruba.
Oh, yeah, that's true.
He's 20 years in prison, which is served concurrently with his Peruvian sentence. So he's going to be 28 years there and then come here and be 28. So this is probably as close to the real story as we're going
to
get.
She has to go back to her hotel, but I was just trying to get dropped off a little bit further away from her hotel so we could walk back to her hotel and I might still get a chance to be with her. Okay. That's what I was hoping for.
Okay. So what happens?
Deepak drops me off at a place, a little right of the Marriott Hotel known as the Fisherman's Huts. This place is not so far from, the next hotel is the Marriott, and the next hotel after that is another Marriott, which is a timeshare, and then it's the Holiday Inn. We walk along the beach.
Deepak and Satish get out, come with you. What happens?
Deepak and Satish leave. They leave. They go back to their home. I assume they go back to their home. They get in their car and they leave. I'm actually with Natalie walking along the beach. I find a space before we get to the Marriott Hotel, where I lay her down. We lay down together in the sand, and we start kissing each other. I get her to kiss me again. We start kissing each other, and I start feeling her up again. And she tells me no. She tells me she doesn't want me to feel her up. I insist. I keep feeling her up either way. And she knees me, she ends up kneeing me in the crotch. When she knees me in the crotch, I get up on the beach and I kick her extremely hard in the face. She's laying down unconscious, possibly even dead, but definitely unconscious. And I see... right next to her, there's a huge cinder block laying on the beach.
When you say cinder block, looking at the walls of this place, is it like those?
Exact same cinder blocks. I see a huge cinder block laying on the beach. I take this and I smash her head in with it completely. Her face basically, collapses in. Even though it's dark, I can see her face is collapsed in. Afterwards, I don't exactly know what, I'm scared. I don't know what to do. I decide to take her and to put her into the ocean. So I grab her and I half pull and half walk with her into the ocean. I push her off. I walk up to about my knees into the ocean, and I push her off into the sea. After that, I get out, I walk home.
And the last note in my notes is, we can only assume this is half-truth, but he's trash.
Bro, that's whole truth.
Oh, that's a whole truth, but...
Sounds confession, yeah, who knows? I mean, what do you think happened to her?
I'd say I think he tried to sexually assault her and she fought back. But the way he says, she kneed him in the nuts, so... He kicked her in the face, essentially, and I believe that because he sounds like a real fucking piece of trash.
Entitled asshole.
Yeah.
If her being down under the water that long, I don't think that there would be anything to find skeletally.
No.
Because the ocean breaks down bone, too, my guy.
All those critters love all that kind of stuff, so.
Picking around in there.
Which, I mean... A long floated theory was his dad took her off on a boat and dropped her out. So that could be the other part of the story that's not Nobody will ever know.
Nope.
But as you said, Stephanie's murder could have absolutely been prevented.
Yes.
And at least I have some closure now. So that's the disappearance of Natalie Holloway. Thanks, guys.
Don't whistle in the woods at night.
Bye, y'all.